This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 1st of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 330 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, Garth Risk Hallberg, the author whose new book, City on Fire, is not only exciting the critics, but is one whose journey to the printed page has been something of a story in itself. Garth will be helping us read between the lines of a publishing phenomenon a little later on.
Then we'll hear from Dick Onbuse, the writer whose love of all things Swiss, from watches to trains, has now led him to compiling a history of the nation through its maps. He'll be joining us to tell us more in the studio.
And we'll be giving a little respect to Erasure. The synth-pop duo have been in the music business for 30 years in 2015 and show no signs of slowing down. Andy Bell from the band will be here to tell us more.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be back in the news look-ahead chair. We'll play some great music too right here on Monocle Weekly on Andrew, hi. You look very well. Have you been away?
I've been away for almost 3 weeks.
That is what I call a holiday.
That was not a holiday.
As our listeners are concerned, they've missed you. We've had letters, we've had things sent in, items of underwear, etc. People have missed you, and don't pretend it wasn't a holiday. Was it a nice holiday?
It started with a bit of a holiday. It moved into the Frankfurt Book Fair. And then from there, it was the Asia leg of our Cozy Homes book tour.
So, yeah.
Hello, we met you in Bangkok, we met you in Hong Kong, we met you in Singapore, and we met you in Tokyo. So we did 4 great events for all our subscribers, and it was, you know, it was amazing, but it was literally a night in each city and then back on a plane. So we did lots of meetings, we met loads of people, but really, we met some really brilliant readers. And the interesting thing is how many people, because of Monocle 24, they know all of us through our voices and things. So thank you for everyone for listening. How about that?
That's very nice. I feel slightly moved by that.
I do.
I would be if I was a Bangkok subscriber. Have you sprained your signing hand? Are you okay?
No,
have you got any more signing left to do? You got any more lead in the pencil?
No. But Tyler did get to the point where he's saying, okay, not too long a request, because people were saying, you know, could you make this out to me, me, my auntie, my cousin?
Congratulations on your new house.
Yeah, and could you write a little kind of essay at the front in no fewer than 500 words? And
so, you're like, it definitely will be shorter than that. That's fine by me.
No, but it was good. And then you have to be very careful because people's spellings of their names, they can trip you up. Like someone said,
you don't just write Gary to everyone.
No. Well, someone said, my name's Ted. And I said, oh, as in, I'm so used to checking out, as in TD. No, as in TAT. Sounds complicated, doesn't it?
That's very strange. We were in Armenia.
You need to get the accents right. I seem to remember you went on tour where you missed a few hyphens out of people's names and then just inserted them afterwards.
It's
a complicated business. Anyway, it was very nice. And we're going to be heading to Reykjavik, Toronto, San Francisco, Amsterdam, all over the next few weeks.
So
if you're a subscriber, we look forward to seeing you with your copy of Cozy Homes.
Cozy Homes. Did you do the voiceover? I think I did the voiceover of that book.
Oh, good.
That's a very good Cozy Homes voiceover. Cozy Homes. Get it now. And the book.
That's another story. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Moving on.
We should start the show proper. Should we wheel out our slick back, dirty news hound, Daniel Giacopelli?
Oh, oh, oh.
Let's get him in here.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day. 'Cause Danny sends me flowers and candy. He's my one.
It's the dulcet tones and baton twirlers of Danny Giacopelli's underage orchestra. Welcome to the program, Danny.
Good to be here, Rob.
They're in fine voice, aren't they?
They are. They sound happier and happier greet me into the studio.
Don't they? And how are you this week? Are you plump of fetlock and happy-go-lucky?
I don't know what that first one meant, but I'm happy.
He's worried about the word plump. He thought you were being a bit rude.
Yeah. Everything's good. How was LA?
That was very nice, thank
you. I'm sure you've talked about that multiple times already.
I don't think we have, actually. No. We talked about Andrew's travels. I never get looking.
But this is for December. This is for the December. Hold on. This is for December-January issue. And you went to meet one of your heroes. But we shouldn't give too much of the game away, but you can say who you went to meet.
Hugh Hefner.
Funny you should mention that. He was staying at Hughes.
Obviously I stayed there.
Yeah, Hughes on Airbnb to make some more money these days.
The fantastic Ed Ruscha. Cool. Great, legendary American artist. Felt very lucky to get a studio visit. A little bit of a tour with Ed.
Very nice.
I didn't go for a drive. I quite like to. I think a great documentary is to be made in driving to the desert with Ed Ruscha.
With him. Because, you know, I just did that last month.
All right.
I drove from LA to Joshua Tree through
that's
the desert.
That's what we want. That's what
get
we
the
want.
TV commissioning editors around Danny. There's a TV show that's going to grip people.
That's an amazing drive.
No, I did actually. I saw all the pictures.
Yeah. That's quite the drive. You're literally in the desert. It was 43 degrees, which is like 105
Fahrenheit. Were you sort of heading towards sort of Burbank and stuff into like that?
Not towards Burbank. You go straight towards like Palm Springs.
Okay.
And then you cut through Joshua Tree National Park, which is like the moon. It's the most bizarre kind of place.
It's great. Even for the flight back, flying over that stuff is amazing. You look down and you just see nothing.
Yeah,
it's very good.
It's a good place.
It's a good place to choose a soundtrack for when you're in.
Okay, that's the holidays done. Should we do?
We have no time now for the news.
Let's do the news. Look ahead.
Okay. So today, Turkey is having general election. Actually, snap parliamentary election amid a kind of crazy atmosphere right now in Turkey. There was the dual suicide bombing in Ankara. There's lots of tensions with neighboring Syria and Islamic State. And Erdogan is increasing his grip on power.
Well, this is kind of vote of confidence sort of thing almost.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, a lot of people thought he was going to postpone the elections after the attack. Our bureau chief, Chris Lord, has his hands full with Turkey stuff right now. I feel like there's a new kind of Turkey development every day in terms of political and security stories. But that's happening today.
Well, and it is extraordinary. He moved there, I guess, just like 6 months ago. And the unfolding of the Turkey story has been incredible since he's been there.
Yeah, it has. Also, this week, more elections. Burma, Myanmar. We say both.
Yeah. So. or as the BBC say, Myanmar, formerly known as Burma.
Yeah, formerly the artist formerly known as Burma.
Exactly. Okay.
That's on the 8th.
We say that.
But people have been voting for a long time, you know. Because when
they've been voting dribs and drabs. Yeah. What is going on here? I don't know.
Because when we were in Singapore last week with the book tour, we went past the Burmese embassy and there was a huge, huge queue of people who
indeed
were waiting to vote. So I guess they someone somewhere knows what's probably happening.
Those might have just been the expats, as they were, the diaspora. The so it's the first nationwide ballot since the end of direct military rule. So it's a big one. Okay, that is the extent of my serious stuff. And now,
for that.
Whew.
I never quite know what face to make when you're doing
that. You were pulling the mood down, Danny.
Remember, Andrew.
Other brands of Hoover are available.
The 5th of November.
Indeed. Guy Fawkes Day.
Yes.
Bonfire night.
Do you get that?
Yeah, of course.
Do you understand
that? I've been here for 5 years.
Okay, and you look like Guy Fawkes these days with that beard.
It's like your Halloween.
Be careful they don't toss you on the fire.
Well, I mean, I do understand it. It's just a lot of fireworks. Okay. Is there some deeper meaning that, you know?
No. I think it's, well, there was a deeper meaning, but
yeah, that's somewhat. It's a long story.
It's based in the great religious kind of tumult of 17th century England, but fine.
Yeah.
Let's just skate over that. Let's just skate over that and go, wow, there's fireworks. Yeah.
The Day of the Dead in Mexico is today.
That's a good one.
Indeed. I've always wanted to go there for that event, but alas. Also, this
week...
Okay,
you've dropped the hints. We'll look at the travel budget for next year.
Okay, so this week I'm going to be in Dublin all week at Web Summit, which is more interesting than it sounds. Honestly, it's not. It's kind of like South by Southwest I can't even say for nerds anymore, because South by is pretty nerdy itself.
Is the one reason that you're returning...
Stop it.
So last year, there were a lot of photos of Danny at this event. And do you know who was his arm candy?
No.
Eva Longoria.
That's not bad.
It was a fun week.
Yeah. what are you and Eva going to be doing?
Couple
this
cocktails.
Particular desperate housewife down a pint of Guinness. you need to really think about this before, because as has been mentioned on this show for the last few weeks, you are sporting a very good beard. But you need to be very careful with things like Guinness with that beard.
She may not recognize you this year.
Things do get stuck in the beard.
Stuck in it.
Okay.
So I have to be careful.
I'll
be there the whole week.
Is she a web entrepreneur?
She's entrepreneurial.
Okay.
She had some projects she was promoting last year. She's actually a very, very intelligent, smart entrepreneur.
Why are you
woman.
Saying actually? We're not saying she's not.
And Eva, if you're listening right now.
I look forward to seeing you.
My
again.
Number is 079. Okay.
Thanks, Andrew. World Travel Market is this week, too. We went there a couple of years ago.
Is that the one down in Monte Carlo?
No,
it's in London.
One.
So the tourism ministers from basically all over the world come and they promote their countries here in London for tourism purposes. Okay, we're going to get sillier and sillier now. We also had the cancer warning for meat this week, didn't we? So poor timing for British Sausage Week, which is this week.
It's fine as long as they're raw, right?
I don't think that was it at all.
That's not right. Okay, sorry.
It's also giant omelet celebration in Louisiana.
What is this? Where do you get this from?
The celebration is giant. Sources. The celebration is giant, or the omelet's giant?
The omelet is giant. They make a really big omelet using 5,000 eggs, apparently.
Each.
And they have something called an omelet mass. Which sounds a bit...
Oh, I see. I thought religious. I thought it meant like, you know, like big mass of omelet.
Oh, no. Well, that too.
How do you toss that? Are you a tosser of an omelet? I mean, like, I think any breakfast chef, any short order chef should be able to toss
forklift or something.
How do you do that? Yeah, exactly. Just drop it from a skyscraper.
And also, to shed the pounds after British Sausage Week and giant omelet celebration in Louisiana, it's the New York City Marathon today.
I like how you've done that.
Do you like that?
Yeah,
that's planning.
Yeah, that's quite good.
Eggs, protein, it's good. Gives you energy. Are we done?
None of us will be doing that.
Is that the end of it?
That's it.
Okay, well,
Danny, are you hungry for more? That's a good thing if you want more.
Danny, thank you
I
very much.
I thought you were going to get a lawnmower race in there. No, he normally does.
Or at least roll a cheese.
Or the pea throwing thing, I think, the other
pea
week.
Pea throwing.
Pea. Remember? Okay, it was, Oh, I don't think you were there for that.
Pea throwing, that's a different kind of party.
I was going to say. And they all landed in the ashtray. See ya.
Thanks, Danny.
Garth Risk-Hallberg is a writer, journalist and author whose work has appeared in the New York Times and on literary site The Millions, among others. The Louisiana-born New Yorker's also published a novella, A Field Guide to the North American Family. But his latest work, City on Fire, a debut novel that unites scattered characters inhabiting the leaner, meaner and notably cheaper New York of 1976 over the space of 900 pages, has caused a stir in the publishing industry that few novels achieve. Even before the book hit shelves, a bidding war between rival publishers for the manuscript became something of a story in itself.
City on Fire unfolds around a Central Park shooting on New Year's Eve, drawing in a ragged ensemble including the reluctant heirs to one of the city's great fortunes and punk kids lost in the era's famed music scene. The book's multiple storylines are masterfully intertwined by Hallberg, and he joined Rob for a chat about how he did it a little bit earlier on.
Welcome to the programme, Garth.
Thank you for having me.
It's one of those things, it's an impressive book to be sent through the mail, whether you're a reviewer and an interviewer, or especially whether you're the author. Is it one of those things, presumably, this is it's a labour of love, it's also a labour of time, finishing a novel like this. Now that it exists and you're out and about talking about it, does it seem more or less real than when you're sitting at your laptop trying to get the words on the page?
It probably feels less real in most ways. You know, having devoted so many years to something, in this case, you know, 6 years, 3 years of drafting, 3 years of multiple revisions, and actually another year of editing, so almost 7 years. There is something really nice about getting that, you know, first box of real books in the mail, particularly if you're someone who grew up venerating books as I did. And there's also something, you know, wonderful about being out in the world and getting to finally meet some of the people who then go off into rooms I'll never see into and read and love or hate or have very mixed feelings about the book.
Don't Google it. Yeah. Don't exactly. Never go there. Although, as I say, this book has been fantastically reviewed on both sides of the Atlantic and all over the world. In the last release I read, it's been translated into 17 languages. Now, there's the thing as well. When you maybe can speak another language well enough to read it or read some of it and make sense of it, how does that work, the translation?
Well,
translation side of things.
I'm sort of happily monoglot. My French teachers would be appalled to hear me say it. I can sort of blunder my way through like Zola in French, but I don't think my French is probably strong enough to make it through the translation. So I'm sort of dependent on the publishers and journalists from other countries to assure me how wonderful the translation is. I'm like, oh yeah, that sounds great. I'll take that. You know, all right. But there is a in a lot of ways, a translator is your closest reader.
Yeah.
Which is really a fascinating thing to be on the receiving end of.
So they get in touch with you and say, you know, it's gonna sound a bit like this in French or German or Japanese or something. How does that work? What's the relationship between you two like?
So I kind of wrote a memo that just said mainly one particular thing that I thought was going on in the language that was palpable but perhaps not immediately available as a principle to translators. So I thought, let me just put this in writing, what I'm trying to go for here and, you know, why some of the language does what it does. And then, you know, I think part of the whole process of publishing a book is learning to let go and sort of surrendering control. Part of writing a book is that as well. I mean, you learn how much of the book is something that you're in control of and how much of it is the book sort of having its way with you and how to best sort of fit those two things together. But really, once you get into copy editing, design, translation, I think learning to just kind of let go is the fastest way to get yourself ready to write the next book.
Garth, I got you to sort of canter off in very much in the direction of having finished the novel and talking about it now that it's out. But I'd love to kind of go back to the writing of it and to the structure of it. Was it always going to be like that, that sort of episodic jumping between characters and stuff? I wonder if you came from writing a novella straight into a big, long novel. Did it sort of help the writing process to break it up into these bits?
The novella was actually written in the space between having the initial vision for this book and working up the courage to actually do it. So I had had this vision in the summer of 2003, which was very inflected by, you know, the 18 months running up to the summer of 2003, which, you know, started in the fall of 2001. Mm. And, you know, we all remember that fall, I think. I'd had this vision in 2003 that was very sudden and felt like something that I wasn't in charge of. Something else was in charge and was saying, this is a book, or possibly this is the book. You are going to write it. And what it was a kind of vision of New York in the mid-70s, which was a time and a place that I'd spent a lot of time unpurposefully daydreaming about when I was a kid, driving around the countryside where I lived, smoking cigarettes and listening to Patti Smith and feeling like she was the only person who got it. That time and that place was somehow going to be the setting through which all of the tensions and questions and baffling, bottomless mysteries that I and everyone I knew had been living through in 2001, late 2001, 2002, and 2003, were going to express themselves through.
So you're not necessarily searching for roots of that post-2001 problem explicitly, but there's some kind of churning of guts there.
I felt it almost as like a reflection or a, you know, some combination of a mirror and a magnifying glass, that all of these tensions between order on one hand and possibility on the other, and safety on one hand and freedom of the other on the other, that had come up both interpersonally and civically and globally after September 2001, also existed in this very visible, heightened, vivid, exaggerated almost state in this other kind of inflection point in the life of the city, which was 1975, 1976, 1977. These were two sort of somehow weirdly parallel time periods, and that all of the sort of emotional, mental content of the time period I'd actually lived through is going to somehow come out by looking at this other seemingly distant time period. And of course, that sounds very insane and capricious to say, but that's like qualification number one for a novelist, is that you'd be sort of insane and capricious. Like, you know, if the novel worked, it would somehow persuade that that time had something important to tell us now. I didn't want it to be a purely historical novel, and I didn't want it to be just a work of nostalgia or something. I really thought of it as like a contemporary novel that happens to be looking for the contemporary in this specific time period. But after that sort of hot flash of vision, which I also saw, I was like, oh wow, it's like Bleak House. Like, it's...
Yeah. Well, someone reviewer in here in the UK said it's like they've sort of morphed Middlemarch into 70s New York.
Yeah, oh, that's so good.
That's all right. That's all right. You'll take that one.
Send that person a gift basket. Because Middlemarch is like, Middlemarch is it. Because yeah. I wanted the social cutaway, right? Like, you get this sort of anatomy of a world, which is beautiful. I'm not saying, you know, the book is beautiful, just that the idea that a piece of art can do that is beautiful. But, and then Middlemarch, you get this like incredible depth of character. And the former thing, the sort of anatomy of the world, was something that I had started to see being done on television and that I felt in this kind of like mock competitive novelist mojo way of like, hey, you know, that's so cool, but you can't have that. Like,
TV's where it's at. I can have
it. It was like, we're
going
to take that back. Like, you learned that from us. But the other thing that George Eliot does in Middlemarch, you know, that you just absolutely live inside these people, is something that I have always felt that only a novel can do. And that's what I remember from novels. Like, I walk away from them and like 6 months later, the plot is productively lost to me. Yeah. So I can reread it again and be surprised. But the characters live with me. Yeah. But that, the idea that a 24-year-old nobody hick whose only qualification to write about the city was the immense love that I'd always had for it was going to even have the hubris to like try to do something like that just scared the bejesus of me. Out of me. So I put it in a drawer and I walked away and I thought I was going to come back to it for 10 years. You know, I thought it was like maybe in 10 years I'll have the chops to write this. And during that time when it sat in the drawer, I wrote short stories and I wrote the novella. But I also learned somehow that the fear I had felt about it in 2003 was actually, that's the signal. When you're trying to be an artist, the fear is the sign that you're onto the thing you should be doing.
In terms of, the novel starts with a quote from television, the 70s New York band. That's nice and refreshing. Was the language of rock and roll music, that type of music as well, that kind of spiky kind of stuff. It's kind of got the same staccato rhythm with which a New Yorker speaks, perhaps. Did that inflect the way you wrote as well? You mentioned Patti Smith. There's street smarts in the language there, but it also kind of get you into the vibe to listen to these records, to get you into the heads of the characters and the language that they speak.
I should just say, like, that album, that television album, what an album.
Yeah.
I mean, it just Marky is Moon. Mind-blowingly good. But part of what I think I've always been chasing in prose, and it's probably unattainable in prose, is a sort of visceral rush of feeling that good rock music gives you. And I mean, prose can do a lot of things compensatorily that good rock music probably can't, but the feeling, you know, and the way that the feeling gets recalled again and again and again with no diminishment, if anything, with an enhancement, you know, by a great rock song was something that I always sort of dreamed of doing in prose, and I still dream of someday doing it in prose, but some of the kind of liberties that I'm taking with the language, you know, which the which alluded to in conversation about the translators, have to do with trying to break some rules to get that feeling. And certainly after, I can't write with music on, but after a day in the at the desk, to get to walk around, you know, with headphones on, listening to that music was a way of staying in the headspace of the book. And it's kind of fun to imagine that walking around and listening to rock music can be a kind of work. My wife still doesn't believe me.
Revision.
I'm like, honey, I'm working. It may look like I'm just loafing, but I'm.
You know,
really
you've written the right book when that's your that's the downside.
Yeah, exactly.
When that's to keep yourself in the zone.
That's like when they, you know, when someone writes a movie with seven locations and they're Hawaii, Paris, Rome, and you're like, oh, you just wanted to go visit all these places.
It's good. It's good. It's good to research.
Yeah,
sticking the needle on the vinyl. It's a good way to do it.
Yeah, I continue to keep my headphones on and kind of let those who do television and film things figure out whatever they're going to do with this. And my job is just kind of to try to write the next project.
That was Rob talking to Garth Risk-Hulberg, and you're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Time for some music now. We've just been delving into a fictional version of New York in the 70s. Let's go back to the real one now. This is Television with Glory. When I
was one of the 1970s New York's most treasured songsmiths, Tom Verlaine and his band Television with Glory.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
You know, Tokyo is fantastic. It's a very grown-up city, you know. It's not a sort of superficial love for Tokyo. It grows, and that's what's really kept me here for so long. So it's just great to live here. Fantastic. I love it. I never get sick of it.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Dickon Bues may be familiar to listeners of Monocle 24, often seeing his unique viewpoint on all matters Swiss, be it politics or pop culture. Dickon's observations on the country extend to his books, including Swiss Watching, while not only looking at the industries it's known for, timepieces, penknives and the like, but also to less celebrated Swiss contributions to the world, such as Toilet Duck, Velcro and LSD.
His follow-up, Slow Train to Switzerland, retraced historic rail travel pioneers who opened up the European continent from the UK to Switzerland in the 19th century. And now Bues is back with another look at the Swiss, this time through the country's cartography, with the new book, Around Switzerland in 80 Maps. And he joins us in the studio now to tell us more. Well, you've certainly got the market cornered in all things Swiss, Dickon. Now, this is a bit of a change of format, not to say the least. Pictorial, bigger, a bigger book,
bigger,
a bigger
better.
Book, bigger, bigger, better. What was the hope for that these 80 maps would tell about Switzerland?
It was partly to bring Swiss history to a different audience. Loads of people love maps, especially at the moment. They're very in. And even people who profess to hate history like looking at old maps. And Switzerland has a really interesting history because of its place in the middle of Europe, because of its unique politics, never having had a king or an emperor or a president or a general. And so the maps reflect the development of the country and how Switzerland grew organically. And so what I was hoping to achieve was, instead of getting people to read a little bit about Switzerland, because obviously the maps go right up to the present day, to actually look at Switzerland in a different way, literally, by looking at a map.
And is Switzerland one of the best places in the world to do something like this because it's been so mapped? I guess you could do it in the UK, but where it's been civilised.
I mean, the big drawback with when I started researching this book and spending a whole year in archives is that for many, many years, Switzerland was the poorest country in Europe. And so there are no early maps at all. Right. So although I start with the beginning of Switzerland in the late 13th century, the first map is actually 1480. And it's a very, very simple map. It shows Switzerland as a round island with a cross in the middle. And so the biggest problem was, although Swiss cartography is very precise, like all things Swiss, and in the 19th century came into its own, the early maps are quite basic in a way, like many medieval maps, but they are beautiful. They're almost works of art in themselves. So I don't think it was any easier or harder than any other country, but it was certainly a challenge for certain periods of Swiss history when I wanted to show specific things.
Quite early on, you say they begin to get quite an accurate picture of what Switzerland looked like. You know, when we think of Switzerland today, you know, that, you know, 100 years ago still, that people lived in their valley. They didn't really kind of cross very much. That's why you have these very kind of distinct dialects and things within one valley, and people feel very attached to their valley. How come that these map makers were actually quite good at putting down on a piece of paper mountains, vast ranges, understanding how the country fitted together, do you think?
Because of where Switzerland is, it was the main route between north and south. If you wanted to trade between Italy and Northern Europe, for instance, you had to go through Switzerland in the days before railways. There was no other route. And so even a lot of the mapmakers like Mercator, a famous mapmaker, never went to Switzerland but drew one of the first really accurate maps of Switzerland based on travellers' tales, merchants he'd met, other people who had drawn maps along the way. And I think if Switzerland had been stuck out on the Baltic Sea or something like that, it wouldn't have been so detailed so early on. But because of where it is and because of its role at the crossroads of Europe with the Gotthard Pass, it was relatively well mapped from an early age.
And Andrew says, as Andrew says, you know, like the people are very proud of their valleys. There's a lot of intercantonal rivalry in Switzerland.
Yes.
Have you upset a few apple carts with some of the representations in here? Or presumably maps, as political as they are, must have... That must come into this as well.
It does come into it. And obviously, I did try to represent the broad range of different language areas, city and countryside. In only 80 maps, it's not always possible, but some of the maps are very political. There's a great map of Canton Bern, for instance, when it was the largest canton in Switzerland in 1700, and it shows the canton as a bear with teeth and claws to show that it's powerful, it's strong, it can stand up to the other cantons, because you have to remember Switzerland in those days was not a country.
Here's the very nice bear.
Yes. And what's interesting about it, it shows Bern's colonies, which are now called Canton Aargau and Canton Vaud, but they were colonies of Bern at that stage. But it leaves out the canton next door, Fribourg, because it was surrounded by Bern and it would have left the bear with a hole in its stomach. So the mapmaker just left it off.
Right.
Because he didn't want to show the bear to be weak. And
an angry bear.
And a lot of people looking at these maps in those days obviously couldn't read or write. And so the map was a very important representation of power and the politics within Switzerland, because it wasn't a country, it was a confederation of city-states.
What I also find fascinating is, you know, we have such a fixed image of Switzerland in our minds as being neutral, peaceful, you know, having dodged the Second World War. We think it must have managed to dodge every war. And here, you know, I think it's a really amazing map where it's the borders between the French and the Russians fighting in Zurich. Now, I never knew that that was ever the case, or that this country had been even invaded so much.
Yes, I think we judge Switzerland by its modern day image. And it was only in 1815 that the international borders were set. And that was after the French had invaded in 1798, which is what you're talking about. And it became a battlefield because of its position in the center of Europe, because of its importance with the trade routes. No one wanted the other side to control it. So the Russians and the French fought outside Zurich and in the streets of Zurich. And it was that battleground of the revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars that led to Switzerland becoming neutral and that neutrality protected, because all the great powers realized it's better to have no one in control, i.e. the Swiss, than the enemy in control of those important routes. So they were all quite happy to let Switzerland hold the ring and to keep everyone else out.
Can you tell us about the men's map?
The men's map is great. So glad the publisher.
I was going to try and set it up in a more intelligent way than that, but
no, it's a sex map of Zurich. Yeah. There's no more intelligence about it. It's a great map that belies Switzerland's conservative status. It's from the mid 70s. It's a fifth edition map, so obviously it sold well enough to go into five editions, and it was aimed at male tourists coming to Zurich to show them where they could find sex. It's as simple as that, and it has great little icons. So there are two men kissing to show a gay bar. It's one of the first maps to show gay bars in Switzerland. There are streets coloured red where the street prostitutes are of a younger nature. They look a bit like a Victoria's Secret model. And there are streets coloured blue where the little icon is a rather dowdy woman with a blue rinse and a fag hanging out of her mouth. And the caption underneath is somewhat over the hill, but half price.
Right, okay.
So very detailed. Yeah. What worries me about it is on the back, it does say tried and tested.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how far the mapmakers went in that regard, but it's really interesting.
Some phone numbers scrolled in on the back of it, right?
Well, it shows you, it gives different gradings for the various brothels and things. And of course, that whole red light district has disappeared now. This is 40 years later. And so it's a really interesting part of social history for the biggest Swiss city, but also a city which has a reputation of being rather boring and grey and full of gnomes, rather than rather lively. And
it's got some quite lively problems, I think, Zurich.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this was a period when Switzerland was relatively liberal compared to a lot of other countries in Europe.
I guess it's also interesting looking at plenty of very contemporary maps, looking at everything from, you know, people's voting patterns to the division of languages across the country, even the how a Swiss supermarket plays out. I also like the one about the Swiss Air, because Swiss Air is obviously a big international player there. It's got its route map from 1949, which is kind of quite limited, but it already kind of sprung into action just 4 years after the war. It was quite an internationally connected place already.
It was, and of course Switzerland recovered from the war much more quickly than any other country in Europe, because it hadn't been directly affected by bombing and invasion. The interesting thing about that map is it's a map to show the first time Swissair had flown intercontinental. So it was the first route to New York, direct from Switzerland. Okay, you had to land in Ireland and Newfoundland on the way. But it showed that Swissair at that stage was an important player, despite coming from a small country, and it had already started intercontinental routes. But yeah, it's again another important little moment of social history to show that Switzerland very often reaches beyond its means.
How easy was it to put the book together in terms of, I mean, where did all the maps come
from? It depends what your definition of easy is.
Well, I wonder how bureaucratic it might be to get your hands on all these maps, and how, when you say, I want to do a book that celebrates you guys, how easy it is to get into the libraries. And
it was relatively easy, partly because a book like this does not exist in Switzerland until now, either in English or German or French, and it's now in all three languages being published simultaneously. So the archivists and various companies were very happy to let me root around their collections. Finding a publisher was relatively easy, luckily. I thought with a big, expensive book, with obviously a lot of investment up front in terms of copyright and production, I was a bit scared that I wouldn't find a publisher, but I found publishers straight away because they liked the idea of the project. Finding the maps was actually the most long-winded part because obviously there are thousands of maps. A lot of them, once you reduce them down to book size, you can't see anything. Some of these maps are 2 meters by 1 meter, so they're huge. So finding the maps took about a year. Pretty much half of them come from the main map library in Switzerland, which is in Zurich. And then the rest are from private companies like train companies or from other collections like Geneva or Thomas Cook here in Britain or the military archives in Germany, for instance. They have let us use the invasion plans from 1940, the Operation Tannenbaum, which never happened. But there's a very simple map showing arrows coming from every direction into Switzerland because Switzerland was surrounded. That's never been published before. So I was quite happy to get those sort of maps in the book. Sometimes it took a bit of persuasion to say, yes, it is a really grown-up book and it will be treated properly. Sometimes there were copyright fees to negotiate for the modern maps. Obviously, the ancient maps don't have copyright fees anymore. They just have scanning fees. So there were headaches along the way, but in terms of the research and writing for the first two books, this was in many ways a lot easier.
And it's just funny, I mean, you obviously start off a project because you kind of have something to say about the subject.
Usually.
But do you...
Not always, but usually.
Well, I wonder whether you kind of felt that you feel differently about Switzerland or you've learned something, there are facets to it that you really didn't realise before you started this project.
Well, certainly, I didn't realise that there was such a sex scene in Zurich in the 1970s. And also, the biggest revelation for me is all the early maps of Switzerland have south at the top.
Right.
Because we always think of maps with north at the top, unless they're rearranged for some specific artistic reason. But up until about 1600, the mapmakers in Zurich and Bern drew what they saw. They saw the mountains, so the mountains form the horizon, which is looking south.
And Zurich's in the top of Switzerland. It's in the north, so they're looking south.
Yeah, so they're looking south. So Zurich and Bern and Basel then become at the bottom of the map, the mountains at the top. And also they're looking towards Rome, which was the centre of everything in those days. And it wasn't until Mercator came along and created the first atlas and invented that term for a book of maps. And he arranged everything with north at the top, which is what we are used to. But if you're a map maker in 1515, you've got no other map to compare it to. You draw what you see, you draw south at the top. So for me, it was very interesting that although the cartography is great, the orientation is kind of weird for our eyes.
Yeah, but kind of more beautiful, mysterious. Because of
yes, and you have to actually think about it. You can't, it's like, where's Lake Geneva? Oh, it's upside down. And obviously there are modern maps in the book as well, which have different orientations for a specific reason, but not as a general rule, just always having mountains at the top.
Well, Dickon, thank you very much for coming to see us. The book is called Around Switzerland in 80 Maps, and it really is a kind of a glorious journey around the country in kind of every plane you can imagine. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You are, of course, listening to the pristine production of London synth duo Erasure, who have given the world such behemoth pop hits as A Little Respect, Sometimes, and Stop. This year, the band, made up of singer Andy Bell and instrumentalist Vince Clark, celebrate 30 years of making music with Always the Very Best of Erasure. And they'll be celebrating well into 2016 with remastered vinyls and also a box set in the works too.
The new hits collection is out this week, and Andy Bell joins us now to tell us about three decades of success in the music biz. Andy, welcome to the
Hello
Monocle
there.
Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to have you here. And we were just saying before we switched the microphones on that all these hits, the time is like water off a duck's back to these hits. Right. Andrew was saying you stick these on at any party, anywhere, and everyone adores these things. Is it a sobering experience? Does it still feel like party time 30 years on?
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's kind of, that's how I feel almost every day, really, you know, because it's gone so fast.
Yeah.
And I really do live for the day, every day. And, you know, when you hear the music and, you know, as you say, see the reaction of the crowd, you know, in the pub or wherever you are, or a disco, I kind of always get really surprised, you know. I'm just like, wow. And it's not just because you're there, they just seem to love it somehow. I think we always felt of ourselves as like a wizard, like the band Wizard,
right, kind okay, of thing, yeah,
but with synths, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, good times.
Yeah,
good times,
yeah,
to roll.
Yeah.
Is that the thing? Do you have that? Did you kind of start off writing some of these tracks which we know so well? Were they slower songs? You thought, let's just speed that up a bit. Let's put that in 2/4 time or something, and suddenly it becomes a disco song. Suddenly becomes something joyous.
Not at all. No, I mean generally they're written in tempo,
yeah,
in the same tempo. We might just tweak it a teeny bit, or sometimes you could even take it down because it's, you know, just sounds better sometimes.
Right.
And then, especially on vinyl, I mean, I know they can change the speed anyway.
You can just change a 45
yeah,
into 33.
But yeah, I mean, some of the more well-known songs as well have been ballads. I'm not sure why people like them, but because you can't really play them in discos. But
the interesting thing is, you know, when I was looking at your discography and your kind of history, you know, you've kind of kept at it. This isn't a comeback or anything. This has been a continuous, interesting, going for it career.
Yeah.
And to do that, you need to have some very key friendships at the base of what you've been doing. How have you managed to sustain that through, I'm sure, very many late nights, tired moments, crazy
right.
days? How have you managed to sustain something
yeah.
really fundamental at the base of it all?
Well, to be honest, I don't really quite know, but I think, I mean, from the very beginning, I was a huge Vince Clarke fan anyway, and I did think it was kismet when we met, and I thought, you know, I should write him a letter, see if he needs a new singer. And the ad I answered was for him. So in the first place, I was kind of, we're in the studio for 6 months doing the first album, which didn't take off in England anyway. And we had, and I was just kind of in the studio staring at him because I couldn't believe there was this man that I'd really admired, you know. So I was very, very shy. It took ages. It took a while for my confidence to build up because, again, I used to rehearse along to Alison Moyet's voice, and people used to get us mixed up in the beginning, you know, until I kind of found my voice. But, I mean, Vince stuck by me because I was first employed as a singer, and he could have said, right, no, that's it, I'm going to move on. But he literally started from scratch with me, and we went round universities and clubs and kind of started building up a fan base. And then our first proper co-write was Sometimes, the song from the Circus album. And we would luckily, you know, it was played on the radio. And I think because we've been with Mute Records the whole time, even though they've been sold a few times and moved around, our catalogue's been spread out and then come back together again, I don't think we would still be here if we hadn't have been with Mute the whole time, because Daniel Miller is a real fan of the music and the musicians, and he's always there behind the production of the album, each album, and he thinks touring is really important. So we've toured most albums apart from two, I think.
Do you find that especially for the two of you as well and the band, that touring, it brings the songs to life, and that so many of the songs have, as you say, have a tempo that they're floor fillers,
yeah.
that you want to see people reacting to that music? Do you sometimes don't know if a song is any good until you play it live?
I don't know. It's quite strange because there was a period when we, you know, you're not played on the radio all the time, you know, every single song you release. So you go and test it, or you go and try it and see how it is live. But when people, before they've heard it, they don't, it's a really a weird reaction,
yeah.
you know, from the crowd. So it's only until they know the song a bit more, you know, but...
The Am I Allowed to Dance moment.
Kind of, yeah. But I mean, performance is the thing that I love the most, I think. I mean, going in the studio is amazing, but being on the stage is what you live for, really. And even when you're writing songs, I'm thinking of, how's this going to be on the stage? Or how will it be presented? What's the reason behind the song? And all those kind of things. So maybe that gives it some quality, I don't know.
And tell me, the other, you know, you're an artist that appeals to all sorts of people, but you had a real commitment and a real voice and a real moment in gay clubs as well.
Yeah.
If you went to a gay club, your songs would always be there at a certain point of time. Did that feed into the music, or was that just an audience that kind of got, as Rob said that slightly upturned tempo at the time?
Well, I think definitely purposely on the very first album, I think maybe one of the reasons it hadn't worked was because I purposely pushed Vince in a direction that I don't know whether he wanted to go in, which was the tail end of high energy music, which was kind of like a genre in gay clubs in the late 70s, early 80s. And so that we kind of missed that, you know. I missed that music as well. But I think from being out from the very beginning, you know, I was inspired by Jimmy Somerville from Bronxky Beat. And he's, you know, he had the song Small Town Boy, which gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. So, and of course, Holly Johnson. And I just thought, well, at that time, it seemed to be some kind of gay movement, a wave going on in pop. So I thought, yeah, I'm going to do it and just say, make it normal, talking about your boyfriend and your partner and all that kind of stuff. And definitely the band became embraced, you know, so we were like selling out in San Francisco, and I got the keys to the city, and you kind of, you know,
how big are the keys to San Francisco?
I can't remember, because it was actually on a plaque. And I've lost the plaque somewhere. So somebody's probably got the plaque.
Let me in.
I know. I've been going onto the San Francisco Council website to see where it's, you know, if there's a list where I can get a copy made or something. Yeah. But anyway.
Maybe you left them in the back of a cab or something.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're going around and touring, and especially like in the late 80s, early 90s, and going to gay clubs in New York and stuff when it was a bit more sleazy, it was so amazing. Especially like hearing your own music in there.
Is that a responsibility? Is that, does it become something from you go, wow, I'm lifted up by this, and it becomes, it breaks out of any sort of scene it might have been. But do you have a responsibility somehow as a spokesman? Was that in the early days?
You kind of do, yeah. I mean, you young people don't know who I am at all. They don't have a clue now, gay young people. And I don't expect them to either. You know, and you kind of, I feel a bit sometimes, it makes me feel like a historical character, you know, that's been forgotten slightly. But yeah, you know, we do lots of gay prides all the time. And, you know, I've honoured to be an ambassador for Harvey Milk School in New York, and patron for Diverse, which is an HIV charity in Cambridge, and stuff for the THT and National AIDS Trust. So you kind of do, I'm not that great of a public speaker, but every now and then it's nice just to go and, you know, rally people round.
I suppose you do it, and doing it with a lightness of, you know, doing it with a lightness of touch is the trick.
Yeah.
And tell me, the remastered versions of some of the songs, you say you feel you don't connect with the youngest audience out there now, but that is surely a chance for those songs to go off on a kind of another round around the clubs and things, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you do. I mean, there's quite a lot of young people that do follow us on Twitter, and I kind of think, I'm not sure how they've joined the dots up, you know, whether it's, because I don't think there are that many that have become children of the adults that heard our music. But I think I think they kind of maybe like modern electronic music, and they've kind of like looked at the history of the music or something.
You're selling yourself short there. Is it?
Well, I don't know.
The DNA of fantastic electronic music. It's mute records. It's all there. It's wonderful, you know.
Yeah. And tell me, it's always a tricky thing for a band that had very big hits, you know, that you know when you do a show, they are needed.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with a song like A Little Respect?
Well, A Little Respect is great because it sings itself, that song. It's amazing, you know, it's such an anthem.
Not with our voices, it doesn't.
we'll join in on the chorus.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, I mean, you fall in and out of love with songs, you know. I mean, O L'Amour kind of, you know, that got boring sometimes, but then I just love the intro. But it is quite tricky picking the ones to sing each time from the catalogue. But obviously you want to put like lesser known songs in there. And then when you're promoting an album, you want them to hear the new stuff. So it is quite tricky putting them all together. But I quite love it because I always feel like, you know, you're creating a playlist and being master of your own show kind of thing by doing that, you know. So.
And does the Greatest Hits package make sort of more sense in this era than it has done before, when people are kind of picking and choosing from albums and not knowing if something's new or old and having the historical lens through which to look at Erasure?
Well, it really feels like an achievement, you know, and I'm very proud of a lot of the songs that Vince and I have done together. And we've not always had a huge, I mean, it was good in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, but in the media, we're not kind of on the TV all the time or anything now. So it's like, I just feel grateful that still to be here and in the industry, you know, and there to be a certain amount of interest. And thankfully, we have a loyal fan base that allows us to still create music and earn a living, you know. I feel just blessed being able to do that, really.
It's well said, isn't it?
Yeah, beautiful.
And what happens with Greatest Hits? Is this an opportunity to relaunch yourself and whiz off on tour? What happens after?
I think this is probably, this is one time that the catalogue's been all in one place. So it's been easier for them to do it. And it's kind of promoting, it's off the back of the last tour, which we did our favourite remix versions of songs. So that's included. Yeah, so hopefully, I mean, I'm meeting Vince in November to discuss what we're doing next year. So hopefully towards the end of next year, there'll be a new show with a new album as well. So I'm not sure how all the hits are going to manage to get in there.
Wow.
You know,
a very long
at that
show.
Meeting, take a big map and you need arrows and you
bubbles.
Need magnets. You need, plot it, plot it out.
Okay.
That's the way forward. And I love Mute Records and I love your records, but not a lot of Mute artists have Greatest Hits
in the sense
that you do. So it's kind of an exciting thing for Mute and for Daniel Miller as well.
Well, Mute's very cool. I mean, Daniel's amazing as well. And he's, you know, he comes to the shows and he's a bit of an enigma, but it's great when he comes. He's very sincere about what he does, you know.
As is Andy Bell. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. Always the best of Erasure is out this week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is it for edition 330 of the Monocle Weekly. Wasn't it nice having Andy Bell on the programme?
Do you know, a bad admission, I didn't really kind of look at the script until about a few hours before the show.
A few hours, yeah.
And, not all of it. I knew some of the guests, and I hadn't realised, because you get the books put on your desk, but I hadn't realised there was another guest at the end. And I suddenly saw he was coming in. I was probably excited to meet him. I thought he was like, I think it's an amazing thing to negotiate 30 years in the music industry without becoming, like, dead. Or crazy.
Or a dickhead.
Yeah, exactly. And he came in and he was kind of, you know, humble and sweet. And I think it's also interesting, you know, there are many bands from that period that kind of, you know, went off and spent all their money and then tried to come back 10 years later as, you know, kind of like, you know, remember the 1980s, whatever, the 1880s, that'd be a long time ago.
1890s.
remember the 1980s. And then suddenly you're kind of some weird kind of like throwback, kind of like odd act. But he's kept at it and he sounds as fresh and as interested and excited about the music industry as you'd imagine someone starting out 30 years ago.
I think exactly he did. He sounded as excited. He still sounded like he was like, I can't believe I get to sit in the studio with Vince Clarke and make records and sing in front of people.
Yeah.
And you get that. There's a palpable sense of mischief and excitement about Andy Bell, which I think is, everyone could take a chip off that block, right?
Yeah, so we had very nice guests. Thank you to all of them. But Andy, you stole the show there a bit at the end.
And Garth Rix Holberg, who I did a couple of days ago, and we played it into this show. He was amazing. That's a book that was kind of like fought over, and it was you've just come back from the Frankfurt Book Fair. That was all, everyone's hearts were a flutter, I think, at last year's event because of him and all the rest of it. He's a pretty cool dude.
And again, being at the Frankfurt Book Fair was incredible to see the passion for buying these how one or two books become the currency of the fair when there are tens of thousands of books there. So him to rise to the top of that, it's a remarkable,
it's quite a thing.
And Dickon Bewes, we love him. He's been on the show a few times, and you know, I love the fact that he's cornered the market in all things Swiss, but with a passion. Yeah, his book about Swiss watching is really entertaining because it tells you kind of all the things you don't realise about that makes Switzerland quirky, individual, unique. But he does it with a kind of charm and wit. Again, is admirable.
We've had a triple bill of...
That was a loving, wasn't it?
Yeah, God, it was a loving, wasn't it?
Should we say thanks to everyone?
Shall we blow a kiss through the glass to our pals? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tucker.
Thanks for tuning in.